Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Sarah Bilston. She is professor of English literature at Trinity College, and we're talking about her new history, The Lost Orchid, a story of Victorian plunder and obsession. Sarah, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be speaking with you today.
This is one of those books. Sometimes I get a book and I go, I have no idea what this is going to be like. This is one of them. I just started reading it, and it was so fascinating and so interesting. But I have to ask you, Sarah, you're a professor of English literature. How did you get involved in this story? Because this is involving a lot of other issues other than literature.
It really is. And I think if you'd asked me, 5 years ago, would I have written a book about orchids, I think I would have looked at you, with my head on one side. Because, yes, you're right, I'm a professor of Victorian literature. So I'm usually, teaching my students about, Dickens and Bronte and all the rest of it. And I stumbled on this story, really. In my last book had actually been about novels that were set in the suburbs in the 19th century. Oh. And while I was researching that book, I got very interested in gardens and gardening. Again, a little bit of a detour for me. But I was interested in novels that had long sections set in suburban gardens. And I kept on finding references to orchids. And, whenever you're a researcher, whenever something seems a little bit odd, when you come across something and it sort of grabs you and you think this is strange, you have to follow it. And that was what happened to me. And the reason, I think, that orchids seemed so odd to me, keeping on finding references to them, was that I had always assumed that if you collected orchids in the 19th century, and this is what I kept on seeing, references to collection, that you would be rich, that you'd be an elite, that you'd be an aristocrat. But obviously, the books I was reading, the ones set in the suburbs, were written for the middle classes. And so the new middle classes, the clerks and the doctors and the lawyers and sometimes artisans who were moving into suburban houses. And I was surprised to see how interested they were in orchids. So initially it was just, I thought that was something odd, but I kind of thought it would be a day or two. I would just figure something out and I'd be done.
God, did you go down that rabbit hole?
Yeah, right. It can be a mistake. Anyway, as time went on, I got more and more interested in why the new middle classes, people who are kind of defining themselves as respectable gentlemen and women, why were they so interested in orchids? And then I kept on finding references to the fact that there was this one that had arrived in 1818, possibly by accident, in a box from Brazil, and it was very glorious once it bloomed, but then nobody could rediscover it. And that across the course of 75 years, so much of the 19th century, there were these efforts to recover it. And I just got more and more interested in that story. And so, yes, you're right. It took me kind of away from my comfort zone. And I just followed this story. And I write, I think, in the book about the fact that it's about a Victorian hunt for an orchid. And it becomes my own hunt. To try to understand, how did this thing disappear? Did it really disappear? Where did it come from in the first place? And I just kept on following the story through different archives, letters, documents. And finally, and I don't want to give away the whole plot of the book.
Don't.
I did kind of discover that my initial instinct that there was something very strange here, I think I was right. And the story of the lost orchid, let's just say it's a lot more complicated than I've made it sound already.
Oh my God, is it more complicated? First of all, this is a history that's also about colonialism, very much so. And we'll follow some of those threads in a bit. Darwin is involved in this. I mean, there's a lot of parallel stories that are involved in this story. And it's very strange. First of all, let's talk about, because this, the orchid itself, and we'll talk about its discovery in just a bit, was found in Brazil. And there was a very strange attitude towards Brazil by colonial powers back in the 19th century.
Right. And I just want to say you're exactly right. And I think, at this story, it's like, you pick up a thread and you start to pull and then you find that it's like attached to, a huge blanket. That was sort of how it felt to me, because it did end up so much became connected in this story. Brazil was a country that Europeans were really, they certainly had their eyes set on it. And my story, of course, focuses in particular on Britain. And although Britain didn't exert direct control over Brazil, of course, over the course of the century, they certainly were trying to figure out how to extend their economic influence.
Well, it was Portugal that had the greatest influence, correct?
Sorry?
Portugal was the one that has the greatest
influence. Exactly.
And that was one of the, I think, just to pause, I mean, for me, that was one of the wildest things, that Britain was so involved in a Portuguese colony.
Yes, absolutely. Right. And so one of the phrases that historians use to talk about to talk about this sort of indirect influence is informal empire. and Britain is very much working to make Brazil part of its informal empire. And plant hunting, funnily enough, is one of the ways that they did this, right? So by sending out plant hunters, they were, first of all, obviously rifling and extracting resources to be exploited by themselves. But also, the more people who they sent out, obviously, the more a kind of infrastructure grows. And it's a little bit like footpaths. You know, the more people walk on a footpath, the easier it is to walk that footpath. And so they're just sending out more and more people, and communities are growing in Brazil who then support new British arrivals and so extend Britain's power and influence. And so I was surprised to see the degree to which botany and plants become part of, sort of quite insidiously part of this larger project of extending European, but specifically in my story, specifically British influence as the Portuguese pull out in the 19th century. So that was a big part of the story, was realizing that this, and it takes on different kind of characters and colors over the decades. But the end of the story focuses on how plant hunters at the end of the century are particularly violent in their determination to not just take a plant that they want, but actually to destroy the ecosystem so that no other plants like that can grow, because they're actually trying to beat out their rivals. So it becomes particularly violent by the end of the century.
It's also about the passion for the exotic. Yes. And it was your writing about that I found really enlightening. Because it's such a part of this. Why are people collecting orchids? Why are people collecting any one of a number of things that's going on in Britain at the time? And it's this wild appetite for the remarkable and the exotic.
That's right. And again, that's part of a larger story of the 19th century. You know, the 19th century, you know, in Europe becomes really fascinated by spectacle and by looking. And there are all sorts of ways in which, you know, we can think about that, right? Photography, microscopes, telescopes. There are so many ways in which the 19th century sort of consumer loved to look. And this is a century in which newspapers are increasingly integrating visuals to attract readers. And as more and more people are reading, and this is a period in which people become more literate and in which markets grow to accommodate a new reading public, one of the ways in which newspapers really competed for market share was by integrating more and more lovely pictures, because people loved to look. And color, by the end of the century, more and more color is used in illustrations. At the start of the century, color is actually very, very hard to use. And in fact, it was often done by hand. There are botanical magazines where like whole families would like get together and literally have to paint the images of beautiful orchids. But by later in the century, it's much, much cheaper, and more magazines are integrating color images. So all of this is just to say that before people had literal orchids to look at, they were really enjoying looking at images of orchids in the news media. But these really remarkable plants that, of course, hadn't really been seen before on British shores before the early part of the 19th century, at least by the overwhelming majority of people, I think part of the reason that this obsession with orchids, that there was even a word for it, orchidomania, or sometimes orchid delirium, part of the sort of the rise, the growth of this mania was that people were fascinated by looking at something new, whether it was initially in print and then later actually on the shelves of suburban nurseries and then in their own bay windows.
But it also has to do with how people thought about other countries, other lands, because this whole idea about the exotic, as you write about in the book, really starts with people looking at Asian cultures and sort of this exotic aspect of it. And then as you bring all this out in the book, there are H.G. Wells writes a weird story about the strange orchid. And there are orchids in Britain and there's orchids in Europe, but people had this idea about Brazil and places like New Guinea, but especially Brazil, as this untouched Edenic land.
That's right.
And you bring up in the book, and this is really crucial, that when the people wrote, they're writing back to the to Britain in their collecting expeditions, they virtually don't say anything about the people who actually live there. It's like there are people living there. It's not like it's a blank slate.
I know. Yeah.
There are all these cultures there, let alone the Portuguese culture, but there are also the endemic people who live there. And
that's right.
They just don't. They're just part of the background.
Yes. So I include a map, actually, of Brazil, a European-made map, which I just think is so remarkable because it's just all blank space. And this language of blankness and nothingness is used repeatedly. Of course, it's wildly false, right? There are just 1,000 tribes, quite apart from the European-descended residents in Brazil. But every time a collector went, it's actually sort of remarkable sometimes, collectors would go out and then they would publish a narrative and they would say, no collector has been there before. And yet when you read their letters, you realize they were actually already staying with other collectors. Right? I mean, they just shamelessly used this language of blankness, even when it was, because it was so important to them to describe themselves as the first.
As you astutely bring out in the book, there was a sort of a form to be adhered to when they were writing back home. There were certain tropes that the plant collectors would use that they knew that they had to put in their letters back home.
Right.
They had to seem like that intrepid explorer fighting the elements and the wild animals to achieve this one goal.
Yes, and as you said at the beginning, I'm a literary critic, not a historian, but I mean, one of the ways in which I think my sort of literary critical training came in the book was when I do work with letters, I try to think about them as genres, right? That's one of the things literary critics always do. If I read a novel, if I'm teaching a novel to my students, I ask them to think, what is the genre that this is? And then how has the author used, changed, disrupted the kind of the typical form? Right, and poetry similar, plays similar. But when I'm reading letters, I think about them as an epistolary form, and then I think, well, how is this writer using, changing, disrupting the genre? And one of the things you often see is it's pretty clear if you set the letters beside the published works, you'll see such a significant difference. And it's very clear that when they're writing the letter, they think, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. And then when it's a published work, they think, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. And in some cases, I could even find communication with editors, which made it very clear that text is being changed in order to fit the intended audience, right? And so that was part of the story that I wanted to uncover, was the difference between the published works and the letters in particular. Because the published works that are written about orchid hunting, plant hunting, work so hard to advance the narrative that you've just been talking about, right? Which is, if we're Europeans, we are entitled to take the resources of other nations.
Yeah.
We're doing it for good reason. It's actually great that we're doing this because we're pushing back the boundaries of knowledge. Our new middle classes are thriving, and it's right that they should experience the joys of nature and learn more about the world, and the exotic is for us to consume, right? And so that's the kind of published story. And then what you find so much in letters in particular is an effort to try that narrative, but it keeps on failing. It keeps falling apart because it's actually, of course, not going well half the time, right? They're struggling, they're failing. They need the support of the people whom they then describe as utterly incompetent, right?
Always.
So again, right, again and again, what they'll do is they'll describe the support they're getting from local people to help them find orchids in the letters as absolutely critical to their endeavor. And then when they publish books, they write about how the people, local people, don't know anything and how they need these bold Europeans to come in and save them. So as I say, part of what I was interested in doing was really thinking about what portrait, what picture of 19th century plants, botany, and just in general, the kind of the project of imperialism, what story emerges when we read the letters next to the published works.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Sarah Bilston. She's professor of English literature at Trinity College, and we're talking about her new history. It's a great read, The Lost Orchid, a story of Victorian plunder and obsession. Sarah, when I began reading this, this reminded me a lot of Tulipomania in the 17th century Netherlands. But it had a completely different element in that it involved other cultures. Tulipomania really was in, once it got going, was really in the Netherlands. People were growing their own and growing different things. But this involved a lot of other people traveling and finding things in other countries. Now let's talk about the queen of orchids. Is it Cattleya labiata?
Cattleya, that's right. Yeah.
Cattleya labiata. Okay, let's give a skeleton of the story about it, how it ends up getting sent back to Britain. It's William Swainson's, right, in his adventures in Brazil?
That's right, yes. And you're exactly right. So, you know, and Tulipomania was also, it was a shorter period of time, more like a kind of classic bubble and burst situation, whereas this goes on for much longer, really close to a century. And it does involve, it's a story that kind of ebbs and flows, right? It has its kind of high watermark, I think, really in the 1880s and 90s, but it's bubbling under for decades before that as well. It involves traveling basically one of the most exciting things that happened, I said at the very beginning that I kind of wanted to pick up this thread and follow it. One of the most exciting things that happened to me was I really wanted to figure out, did this orchid, was it really lost? How was it found?
Don't give it away.
I won't. But I will just say I came across an archive held at Kew of letters from one company in particular. And I'm going to tell you something that I didn't know. There were these major multinational nurseries, right? Meaning, plant involved businesses in the 19th century. And one of the largest, a huge archive of their letters, memos, bills of lading, and more, were at Kew, at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, London. And they had hardly been looked at all. One biographer looked at them in the 1970s, but that was pretty much it. They weren't properly, weren't fully archived. You can't even find them, at least last time I looked. By searching online, I had to contact them, and then they sent me a sort of typescript page. It was pretty thrilling. And there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages. And this archive was like a historian's dream, right? Because they were so rich in information about the hunt for this particular orchid. And the letters themselves, I find them incredibly moving. You know, they would be water-soaked because somebody had fallen in the Amazon. They would be ripped and torn because somebody ripped them as they were opening them. And the other remarkable thing was that the business office had actually annotated them when they arrived. So they were incredible because it gave me a sense of both how the hunter who had written the letter in the first place, wherever he was, all over the world, right, not just in Brazil, so I learned about their experience, but then I also learned how the business office experienced the letter, and they would underline things they found especially important. And just to touch on another major thread in the book, what I learned from this, both from the letters and from the annotations, was the degree to which the well-being of the plant hunters was not at the forefront of the company's attention. And the letters are just full of these desperate plaintive pleadings for money, and the business office was obviously not interested in advancing more money. And they would literally at times abandon hunters if they thought they were getting too expensive.
We only have about 5 minutes, 6 minutes left. But William Swainson, who has adventures in Brazil, he sends back a shipment of roots, essentially, of the ore, because he doesn't even... And he's really skimpy on the details where he exactly found any of these.
Yes.
And then somebody grows them, and then the orchid is described, and I think even more importantly, it's put in a book, and these books were very popular at the time, natural history books that would have these beautiful pictures and prints.
Illustrations, yeah.
And all of a sudden, the knowledge of that particular orchid comes out, and it becomes an absolute craze to own this orchid.
Right, I talk about it as kind of the pinup orchid.
It really is.
Because it really is. And every, it's like it just keeps on getting reproduced. And, different, I remember I said it earlier on that the magazines are also trying to integrate color. And so all the big botanic magazines, and again, you may be thinking, who wants to read that? But I think people really did. They were actually, remember, they were glorious and beautiful. And even owning and having them was a way of sort of showing your neighbors that you were of the moment, that you had a little extra money to spend, so you must be doing quite well, so you were being a successful middle-class resident. So people really did love these magazines. And they all the big ones would take a turn at centering this and trying a different illustration of it. And so by the 1850s, so remember that this thing sort of first shows up in 1818, by the middle of the century, it's been described as like, oh, this is almost boring now. Like, we've seen this so many times because it's so glorious. But remember, you see, the thing was nobody had found more. and so on the one hand, it was something that people were becoming really familiar with just by looking at it. But where was it? Because as you say, William Swainson, when he first sent it, was very skimpy on the details. And then his life kind of combusted. I got very attached to the characters in this book. And
well, he was the guy that moved to New Zealand, right?
Yeah, he got really cross and grumpy. And his wife died. He got left with a bunch of kids. I really do feel for him. And he just like up sticks and went to New Zealand and was kind of not heard from. At least, obviously, he was heard in New Zealand. But as far as his former friends were concerned, he'd kind of vanished. And so where had he found this thing? He really hadn't given any clear explanation. And so the only orchids that were this kind, this particular variety of Cattleya labiata, the only versions of it that existed were descendants of the original plant. And it reproduces slowly, and it's tough to reproduce, so there were very, very few of them. So in other words, I guess what I'm saying is you have a lot of interest in this plant, a lot of sense that it's super valuable and desirable, but very few of them. And that creates exactly the right circumstances for increasingly desperate attempts to recover more.
I want to just, in the last remaining few minutes, I want to talk about, originally, collecting orchids in Britain really was the realm of people who were wealthy. They're people of means, because first of all, it's not easy to keep orchids. Although later, and that's a whole other part of your book, there's this whole pitch for everybody can grow orchids.
Yeah, orchids for the million.
And orchids for the millions.
That's right. The million meant the masses. And there were even articles published as early as 1850 called Orchids for the Million, basically, pitching them to everybody.
But I can tell you, orchids are really tough to grow for the most part. And anyways, it was one of these precious commodities that rich people, that was a sign of your wealth, was what you had in your collections. And especially this big, flashy, wild orchid, the Cattleya labiata. And first of all, even the naming of it, like labiata, it had a sort of a sexual subtext.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, it was very sort of, very desirable and exotic and glorious. At the early part of the century, you had to be rich in order to be able to afford these things. And I mean, a single rare orchid was selling for, you know, about, in today's money, about $100,000, $120,000 a plant, right? So these things were, if you could find the super desirable, super valuable orchid, then, you know, as a plant hunter, you could hope to make a lot of money and really make your name. And earlier in the century, that's right, you had to be very rich. But even by the middle of the century, the more, remember I said that these ecosystems were just being rifled.
Oh, God.
Orchid hunters didn't just take a single plant. You know, when
they would take everything. They would wipe it out.
Everything. They took everything. And even if they thought that some plants that they found weren't good enough for sale, they would just destroy them because they wanted to make sure nobody else found them. So anyway, I mean, they were arriving, and I found some wonderful descriptions. I mean, not wonderful in a good way, but kind of remarkable descriptions of them arriving, you know, just crate upon 20 crates at a time. And then sometimes terrible things would happen, and, you know, they would all freeze in the night before the
orchid. Oh, yeah, yeah.
But enormous quantities were arriving, and the more that arrived, of course, the price would drop for that particular variety. And so these suburban nurseries, often nurseries would set up in the suburbs because that was, of course, partly where their market was, and also it was very accessible. Suburbs tended to have good transportation networks. And so they would set up, and then they would invite the middle classes to come and buy orchids. And so very, very quickly, as I say, by the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 1850s, 60s, 70s, to own an orchid was very much something that an average consumer could do. Not the lost orchid, right? Not certain varieties. They remained out of reach. But many orchids that 20, 30 years earlier had been very desirable, they were now something that all of us could hope to own.
Was this part and parcel of Britain's passion for gardens and flowering plants at the time?
No, exactly. And again, I think it's a lot to do with the rise of the middle classes, to be honest with you, because I mean, the 18th century garden is really associated with, you know, the country house.
Yep.
But in the 19th century, right, the standard middle class house would have a little garden.
We're going to have to end here. We're completely out of time, Sarah. We can talk about this. We didn't even get a chance to talk.
Sorry.
No, don't worry about it. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Darwin. That's a very interesting section of this book.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, say no more. Say no more. My guest tonight is writer Sarah Bilston. She's professor of English literature at Trinity College, and we're talking about her new book, her new history, The Lost Orchid, a story of Victorian plunder and obsession. Sarah, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.